From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. Here's what's happening. The deadly Ebola outbreak can be ended by the middle of next year if the world speeds up its response, according to the UN Secretary General. But he warned that although the rate of the new cases was slowing in parts of West Africa, Mali, where six people have now died, deep concern. More than 5,400 people have died in three countries, along with a handful in Nigeria, Mali, Spain, and the United States. In the St. Louis area, law enforcement sources are confirming that two men were arrested in connection with a plot to explode pipe bombs during protests. Authorities say the two men were arrested near Ferguson and were apprehended as part of an undercover operation. They were arraigned in federal court on Friday. Prosecutors have made preparations to announce the eventual decision by a grand jury on whether to charge a police officer who shot dead an unarmed teenager in some local school said they would close next week in anticipation of unrest. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder has urged police to show restraint in handling any protests that flare after the grand jury's decision as tensions simmer in Ferguson, Missouri, over a case that has now become a flashpoint for U.S. race relations. The grand jury deciding whether to indict Darren Wilson in August 9th shooting of Michael Brown, who was 18, in that St. Louis suburb, has met behind closed doors. Their decision expected very soon. Steve Gregory, of course, is a reporter for our Los Angeles affiliate, KFI. He is in St. Louis. Steve, can you give us an update on what's going on tonight?
Actually, tonight, George, and I can tell you this much, that there's a lot of tension here because it's presumed that the grand jury, who's been meeting now behind closed doors for weeks, has completed its deliberations. And we're told by sources with knowledge through the DA's office here that they perhaps finished their deliberations today, and we could get a decision publicly on the indictment on this coming Sunday in 2 days. And that's when all of the public officials say that's when they're prepared for any kind of unrest. Now, today, earlier, city and county officials held a press conference to reiterate the fact that they are prepared for almost anything that takes place here, and they're also asking for people to calm down. They're asking for people to really take a step back from this and realize that violence and vandalism are not the way to go in this particular case. And even the father of Michael Brown, Michael Brown Sr., he posted his own message last night online asking for the same thing, that he didn't want his son Michael to die in vain. There have been a lot of requests from a lot of very high-profile people here to actually take a different approach to this, make it a peaceful protest, and make it one of a message and one of unification and not one of violence and vandalism.
Let us hope, Stephen. Protest is good, but when they start looting and maiming and doing all kinds of things, then it gets out of hand. How long are you going to stay in the St. Louis area?
I am scheduled to be here through Tuesday, George. We're hoping that decision comes down Sunday morning is what we're being told right now, and that's an unofficial, unconfirmed time. But we're told, based on the fact that the districts have closed the schools for Monday and Tuesday in anticipation for this, and also the fact that the holiday week is coming up as well, they don't seem to think that's going to be a big deal to close it for those 2 days. So that, combined with the fact that we've found out that 80 additional federal agents have now arrived here in the St. Louis area, and the unified command structure has been put into place, we're thinking that all of that is going to add up to getting a decision in the next 48 hours.
Sometime Monday, circle your calendar. I'll be in St. Louis, so let's get together, okay?
You got it, George. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Thanks. Steve Gregory, a reporter, great reporter at KFI, our affiliate in Los Angeles. And, of course, Howard Bloom, I always turn to Howard. He's just an expert in human behavior. Howard, I wanted you to elaborate on the possibility of civil unrest. I don't think it's fair to start predicting what's going to happen. However, I do have to say, why do people, you know, loot and get out of control when they're supposed to be there to protest something else?
Well, there are seven hotspots of this kind of madness this week. It isn't just Ferguson. And all of them revolve around something that's extremely primitive. And it's something we share with our animal cousins. It goes back to our instincts. And that's who is up and who is down in the pecking order. Here are the week seven key insanity points. They're Ferguson, immigration, Israel, Iran, ISIS, Bill Cosby, and the snow in Buffalo. And you might wonder how the pecking order comes into this and how these things relate. But to see how, just look at Ferguson. Ferguson is a black rebellion against the status quo so low on the pecking order that policemen sometimes seem to take killing young black men as a matter of course. So police fear black men because their rate of violent behavior is higher than that of most other groups. But a huge black middle class has emerged in the last 40 years. And its young men are being stopped and frisked and sometimes killed, even when they have advanced degrees. So the black community is outraged. There's this huge pressure for peaceful demonstration. It's coming even from Al Sharpton. But the organizers, and I haven't been able to pin down exactly who they are, the organizers plan 75 hands down for justice rallies in 28 cities if a grand jury doesn't send white policeman Duren Wilson to trial for the killing of 18-year-old Michael Brown. So meanwhile, on the other side, old racial fears are cropping up in Ferguson's white community. England's Daily Mail, which is not known for its accuracy, it sometimes wildly exaggerates, but it reports that one policeman was told by an angry protester, quote, "We're going to rape your wives, then we're going to kill them, and we're going to kill your children." Now remember, the Daily Mail often exaggerates. But the turmoil in Ferguson is a struggle between a black community that wants to move up, and here's a key point. It's a struggle with a white community that is afraid that it will move down in the pecking order if blacks move above them. And the same sort of thing is happening over our immigration policy. It's happening between Palestinians and Jews in Israel. It's happening while Iran is trying to climb the pecking order and become a nation on a par with France, a superpower, on a par with France or England. You know, the deadline comes on Monday for the end of negotiations on nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran. Why does Iran want nuclear weapons and nuclear plants? For prestige. It wants to rule the worst world, the roost, in an Islamic world that's 13,500 miles wide from Algeria all the way to Malaysia. Why is there a civil war in Syria that's killed over 190,000 people? Because Saudi Arabia wants to be the ruler of that roost, and it's trying to pry Syria away from Iran's hands. And then, if you look at it from an evolutionary biology point of view, status, pecking order status, is all about access to sex and attention. And that feeds into, of all things, the Bill Cosby case, because Bill Cosby was at the top of the pecking order. He had 3 years with I Spy in the 1960s, and then he had the Cosby Show, which ran from the 1980s to the 1990s. You would think he could get all the groupies he ever wanted. But we hear these weird stories about him drugging women.
Too many weird stories,
Howard. Yeah, and raping them. And one of the women who has come forth this week was an account executive in my company, the Howard Bloom Organization, LTD, when it was the leading PR firm in the music industry. And 35 years ago, actually, she told one of my clients a story. It sounded really, really weird that Bill Cosby had somehow drugged her. And when she'd woken up, Bill Cosby was trying to penetrate her. She made up a story on the spot. She was totally disoriented. But she said, "I have a vile sexual disease." So Bill Cosby backed off and used another orifice. Then she was with Bill Cosby at a party. Now, look, if you're in show business and you meet somebody incredibly powerful, even though he's done you something wrong in the past, you have to pretend to be friends for at least the moment. Well, Bill Cosby handed her a drink. She woke up in Bill Cosby's bed. So she's been in the Washington Post, she's been on CNN, and because she told that story 34 years ago, and it wasn't a copycat story, George, she didn't know anybody else who'd experienced the same thing. Now there are 15 women who've come forward.
Well, Howard, here's my point, though. Yeah, I wanted to concentrate on, of course, what's going on in Ferguson. The world is in chaos, and it's not getting any better.
Right. And it's all about who's on top and who is not. That's the situation in Ferguson. That's the situation with Bill Cosby, was taking sexual privileges that belong only to alpha males. And it's certainly what's been going on in Israel, in Iran, with ISIS, and even with the immigration issues.
Howard Bloom, websites linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Wireless surveillance cameras, webcams, baby monitors allow users to stream video on the web anytime from anywhere so they can always keep tabs on things, right? Their blinking lights signal security. Thousands of seemingly secure feeds on everything from cribs to a pet's litter box. They're making their way online for all to see now. A hacker, for example, from Russia broke into more than 70,000 cameras from more than 200 countries, including the U.S., and posted the live feeds on his website. So just be a little more alert about that. 5 months after radio legend Casey Kasem died, a Los Angeles judge has denied a request from his oldest children that their father's remains be returned from Norway so they can bury him in a Hollywood cemetery. A judge ruled that Kasem's widow, Jean, has the authority over the remains. Cher has canceled the remainder of her Dress to Kill tour after doctors advised that she needed more time to recover from an ongoing viral infection. The singer said she was devastated. Nothing like this has ever happened to her, she said. A total of 29 dates canceled, including shows in New York, Boston, Chicago, and Toronto. And speaking of Toronto, I had a great chance to meet up with our dear friend Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, that was fun. I had a great time with you.
That was wonderful, George. And let me compliment you on your ability as a solo singer on stage. You did a terrific job. And I have to compliment our audience. I don't know that I've ever met a nicer group of people in an audience than our audience in Toronto. It was just a lot of fun, and I'm grateful to you and your engineer, Tom, for having included me in that session. It was a great time.
Now, what's going on in the world of UFOs, Peter?
Boy, I wish I could report, George, that nothing's going on, but I would like to add one extra item to Howard Bloom's list of seven hotspots, and that's UFOs. I, honestly speaking here, I don't believe I've experienced a month that has provided me with more dramatic and unusual reports than this month of November. Going back to the 1st of November, Saturday morning, opening deer season in northeastern Texas, Sulphur Springs, about 80 or 90 miles east of Dallas, a deer hunter, very well-educated man, was sitting on his deer stand up in a tree looking at his deer feeder about 80 yards away, he estimated, looking through his binoculars, and he suddenly became aware that his whole area around him was brightly, brightly illuminated. This is 6:40 in the morning, about 20 minutes before sunrise. He pulled his binoculars down, and his peripheral vision immediately told him that whatever the source of the light was directly above him. He looked up and saw three very bright white or amber lights streaking across the sky. They had a sort of a halo of smoky light around them. The whole cluster banked to the southeast, so it was maneuvering, and suddenly winked out and disappeared from his sight. It's very interesting that within seconds, George, another party reported something very similar. A young woman was driving south on Texas Route 9 near Holland, Texas, and saw something very similar. Both of those reports are posted to our website, and people may read them. They're really very spine-tingling. But it doesn't stop there. Another deer hunter out near Gilson, Illinois, northwest of Peoria, on the 16th, last Sunday, I believe that was sitting on his deer stand about 3:30 in the afternoon, and he saw a light approaching his position. He quickly realized that it was much closer than he had initially allowed for. It came right up to him. It was the size of a marble and about the color of clean engine oil. He reached out to touch it. It was that close, and it suddenly dropped to the level of his feet as he's sitting in his deer stand. Then it came back to eye level and dropped again and disappeared in the forest. Yesterday, and it's getting more interesting still, a woman was driving near Jacksonville, Florida, 10 o'clock in the morning. She's driving south on Highway 9W. She looks up in the sky. She sees two fighter aircraft mm-hmm. streaking across the sky. She later identified them as F-22 Raptors. our most advanced, most recent fighter, and to her great amazement, a highly reflective ball, she alleges, dropped down out of the sky vertically, suddenly stopped, accelerated past the two fighters, passing between them, she thinks, and then departed vertically. Lots going on. We just posted about 175 reports.
That's huge.
This afternoon, and there are more reports still, even as dramatic as the ones I've just recounted. There's a lot going on, and if people see these things, we request that they fill out a report form and send us a report.
UFOCenter.com. Peter, thank you so much. Up next, an incredible story called Wild Connection. Well, I'll tell you about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Over the next couple hours, we're going to talk about animals, wild connection. Dr. Jennifer Vertelin is an animal behavior biologist, the scholar in residence at Duke University. Now, Jennifer blends some humor and science to show the similarities between humans and animals when it comes to certain areas of our life. Fascinating. Jennifer, how did you even begin to study this?
Hi, George. Thanks for having
me
on. I'm really excited to be here. Well, you know, I think like a lot of people in my field, as a kid, I was fascinated by animals. I had a menagerie of pets, everything from mice to guinea pigs, you know, to your traditional dog and cat. And I just wanted to be around animals all the time. And so what I started to do when I was going to school and in my undergrad, I started taking science classes. And then I saw a National Geographic show on a gorilla orphanage in the Congo, and that completely changed my life. And it was, and I'll never forget, the man's name was Michael Atwater, and he was for the John Aspinall Foundation, which is still operating today in rehabilitating orphaned gorillas. And I thought, okay, all I want to do is go to Africa and hang out with gorillas. And so I called the man in the Congo and said, hi, I'm Jennifer, and I want to come and work with gorillas. And, you know, he was very polite, but I didn't end up going to the Congo. Instead, I ended up continuing going to college. And, you know, while I was getting my undergrad degree, I became a volunteer at the Center for Great Apes, which rescued chimpanzees and orangutans from the pet industry and from the movie industry. And that's where I really started becoming fascinated about behavior and why they were doing certain things and the similarities between us and other animals.
Now, let me ask you this too, Jennifer, as we get into this, because this is a fascinating work that you did with Wild Connection.
Thank you.
We've heard some horror stories about chimpanzees and just how vicious they can be, you know, ripping off somebody's face, body parts, sexual organs. I mean, unbelievable. What makes them so vicious?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I mean, you know, chimpanzee society is not just vicious. It's all kinds of things. They show great empathy for one another. They have a lot of hugging. They look out for each other. But they also have intense competition, and primarily where you see that kind of, in the wild at least, where you see that kind of aggression from one chimpanzee group to another, it's usually two communities that have gone to war. And, you know, and they call it war. The people who have studied chimpanzee behavior, it's very analogous to human warfare. And other animals like ants have warfare as well. So, you know, We look at it and call it vicious, but really it's not so different from the kinds of things that we also do, and it's almost always competition for resources, whether it's property that contains food or whether it's mates, right?
And you're convinced that the animal behavior is very similar to human behavior.
Yeah, I think I sort of flip it the other way around in some ways and think that, the behavior that we see in humans has its roots many times in biology. And it doesn't explain all human behavior. We're very complex. We're much more complex than most other organisms. But if we don't look at our biology and if we disconnect ourselves from that, then we're missing a big piece of the puzzle about what drives our behavior. And I think that, you know, my focus is to try to shine a light on some of those places where we intersect with other animals so that we can have a better understanding about why we do some of the things we do and why we have some of the issues we might have, whether it's in our relationships with each other or even our relationships with animals.
All right, let's get into those when we come back in a moment, Jennifer. This is fascinating. Wild connection. We're talking about what animal courtship mating tells us about human relationships. We'll take calls next hour as well. I'm George Norrie. It's Friday night, and you know what that means right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Dr. Jennifer Vritalin. Next hour, we'll take phone calls and, you know, share your animal stories with us. What kinds of animals did you refer to in your book, Wild Connection, Jennifer?
Oh, gosh. You know, I really wanted to cover as many different animals as possible. I mean, everything from ladybugs to dragonflies to, you know, green frogs. And, you know, because I think we all may find it very easy to relate to primates and great apes. And I thought, you know, gosh, if you could see yourself in a fish or, you know, like a guppy or a ladybug, you know, that would really take people by surprise.
Did you find in your studies that these animals, in your opinion, might have souls just like humans?
Well, you know, I actually believe that all animals are individuals, and now we are finding with a lot of our research in animal behavior that, you know, our intuitive feeling about that, that many of us have, is being reflected in really discovering how variable individuals within any species are. Even water striders have personalities. And so, you know, I think that that we're finally getting, as scientists, more creative about being able to quantify that so that we can confirm what a lot of us already know.
Now, have you found that the animals are looking for a long-term mate, or are they just out to have a good time?
Well, you know, it really depends on the species. There's so much variation
really?
Out there. Oh, yes. So, you know, I mean, if you're a Tasmanian devil, the way your situation is, you're really kind of a fly-by-night, not looking for commitment type of individual. And, you know, and that's both males and females. But in species where both individuals, males and females, are required especially to raise offspring, you find long-term partnerships, and those partnerships, I mean, even a skink has a relationship that like can last 20 years.
That's amazing.
I know, right?
What about like goldfish? Did you look at them?
Well, I didn't look at goldfish in particular, but I did look at guppies. And so in guppies, you have more of the, you know, not looking for a long-term kind of thing happening.
Guppies are that way?
Yes, a lot of fish are that way.
And they have like a million babies, don't they?
Well, they do. And in fact, in most fish, it's the male that takes care of the eggs and is the parent.
That's true. It's like the seahorse, right?
Exactly, exactly. And in fact, French angelfish are one exception. They are monogamous and will mate for life and have they live up to 10 years. And so they stay with one partner for that entire time.
All right, let's equate some of this, Jennifer, to humans.
Okay.
And tell me the comparisons on, you know, like pick a couple birds, for example, and compare it to a human. Where are the similarities here?
Okay, so one example might be, you know, in what we might find attractive. You know, as humans, we do pay attention to physical appearance. And we use that as a cue to, as one cue, at least, as to who might be a good quality mate. Because ultimately, you know, in some sense, from a biological point of view, we're trying to reproduce and have the best quality offspring. And in that case, we want a good partner. And when we look at an individual, that's the first thing that we see as a criteria. And this is very true for many, many species, including birds. So peacocks are everybody's familiar with the male peacock with his very, you know,
feathers,
flamboyant
and all
that. Tail,
right?
And
I have a peacock costume, by the way, that I wear on Halloween.
You?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh,
I'm kidding.
I thought that would be great. But and if it had over 150 spots, all the females would think you were super sexy.
I would be the peacock. That's
you
for sure.
The peacock. And the reason for that is not because female peahens are counting how many spots a male has, but male peacocks that have over 150 spots are the most symmetrical. And so symmetry in our physical appearance is usually an indicator of of good genetic quality.
Well, now, with the animal kingdom, and let me talk about the human kingdom for a moment, I think you're right. I think initially the attraction is probably physical and looks for both, you know, the male and the female. But as you get into it, Jennifer, if they don't have that personality, if they don't have that little snap that you need, it's not going to work. And I have seen, you know, whether I'm in Los Angeles or wherever, some incredibly attractive women.
Right.
But once you get to know them, they don't have that kind of personality. You know, they're just, they're not fun, or maybe they're not really nice, you know, or maybe they're, you know, they make fun of somebody who comes into a room. I don't like that. Are animals like that?
Yes. And, you know, and so you're so right about that. But it, again, it depends on what you're doing. So for animals that form longer term partnerships for a season or multiple seasons, so great tits. It's a small passerine bird. This is a great example where personality matters. Of course, physical attraction has to be there, right? You have to match in that sense.
Sure.
But they need to match on personality too. So for great tits, this means that, you know, some are explorers and others are more couch potatoes. And so they pair up with individuals that are more similar to each other in personality, and they do better. And even cockatiels, they have to be compatible behaviorally. Barnacle geese, they have to be compatible in terms of body size. So that's a physical trait. But so it is beyond just what you find attractive, even for animals.
Well, and I have found that, you know, a woman who's cute, doesn't have to be gorgeous, but has a stunning personality is more attractive than a woman who may look better.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, one of the great things about the human species that I think we have an advantage is there's so much variation in what people find attractive, whether it's physically or personality-wise, intelligence. And, you know, you see the same thing in animals. I'm going to use another bird example, you know, bowerbird females and even Japanese macaques, a primate. So those females will prefer a nicer male over the dominant male.
I have always heard that women, human women, sometimes would prefer a bad guy to a good guy.
Yeah, well, you know, this might depend on what stage in her life that woman is. And I think that, you know, this is a common mistake that we make, and that's an attraction to maybe the alpha type of male. And, you know, the problem for that is they don't make good long-term partners. Because when we look at animal species that have alpha males, those are usually not long-term partner type of species.
Do animals like dogs, do they deal with stress in conflict? And if they do, what would create stress for an animal?
You mean in terms of their interaction or relationship with another?
Yeah, or in their own life, basically.
Oh, for sure. I mean, all kinds of things stress animals out, and dogs would be included in that. But for most animals, things that cause them stress are just finding enough food. They could be, you know, being under risk of being eaten by a predator. It could be even, you know, feelings of jealousy. There was a study that just came out a few months ago showing that dogs get jealous. And they get jealous, and most people who own dogs already know this, but they were able to show that dogs are very jealous of attention or affection that their owner gave to even a stuffed dog. They knew the difference. Yeah, they knew the difference between a pail and a stuffed dog. And most dogs didn't react if the owner spoke to the pail. But they really, you know, tried to interfere with their owner petting a stuffed dog. And this creates stress because you're trying to maintain a social connection with another individual, and a third party is interfering with that. And that can create stress.
Who's the aggressor? In let's say a couple cats, is the female aggressive or is it the male?
It really depends. You know, I think females are aggressive with each other mostly. So you'll have mostly same sex aggression, but that's not always the case. And one of the things that I found that surprised me the most was how much human females are more physically aggressive with males than vice versa. except that when males are aggressive with females, you usually end up with more physical injury.
Well, that's interesting. When I was a little kid, I loved science. I did it all. I had chemistry sets, microscopes. I launched rockets. I had pet hamsters. I even bred little hamsters.
Oh,
and
really?
And I studied up on them. And this is interesting. You cannot put the male hamster in the female hamster's pen without her beating the heck out of him or eating him alive. It just doesn't work. If you want to breed them, you got to put her in his, and then you take her out.
Yeah, well, you know, and female aggression against males is very common in other species like hyenas, ringtail lemurs.
How about the black widow spider?
Well, yes, but here's the thing about the black widow spider. You know, the problem with, you know, there's this image that the female is just eating all the males. And yes, this does happen quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
but they've actually done some studies, and the males aren't sort of committing suicide willingly, you know, giving up their life to mate with a female. You know, the reality is that black widow spiders, both males and females, are just hyper-aggressive spiders. They really don't like each other at all. They're not the least bit social. So all this hyper-aggression is kind of a problem when it comes to having to get up close and personal.
Okay, so guy goes into a bar, he's with his buddies, and they kind of say, come on, and coaxing him on, go meet those girls at the bar. Go ahead and do that.
Right.
Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he's got a lousy line and it doesn't work. And he gets rejected. Do animals reject?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, you know, this is one of the great lessons I learned in my whole experience was, you know, animals are constantly rejected. For example, the Mediterranean fruit fly. I mean, it sounds like it's not much.
Oh, right? Who would study the Mediterranean fruit fly and his mating habits?
I mean, most people study it as a pest, but
we used to call them Drosophila in school.
Yes, you've got Drosophila, and they are actually a sort of standard organism for a lot of scientific research. But in terms of, you know, the mating sort of rituals, Mediterranean fruit flies, I mean, these males, they go all out. They sing, they dance, and they have these little spatulas on the top of their head, and they really are doing everything they can to convince a female to pick them. And 90% of the time, they're rejected.
Because they're too goofy.
Well, elephant seals, you know, aren't necessarily goofy, even if they're not the most attractive. But you have the same thing happen there. You know, there's a lot of rejection being doled out in the animal kingdom. And, you know, it's all about compatibility. So something you were saying earlier about, you know, somebody can look good on the outside, but if they're not compatible with you at a personal level, there's going to be a rejection. And you know, we see the same thing in animals, constant rejection. And
that's amazing.
Yeah.
They would pick up, let's say, the difference in two personalities and pick the one they like or they, you know, kind of match up better with.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
How about divorce? I mean, our human divorce rate is 50%. What about in the animal world?
Well, for the animals that form lifelong or long-term relationships, they do quite a bit better than we do, I have to say. You know, albatrosses are sort of heralded as the epitome of, you know, lifetime relationships. And they do divorce, but it's a roughly 7 to 8% divorce rate, you know. And, you know, part of the reason for that, I think, is that when it comes to picking a mate, albatrosses take 4 years to date, you know, as teenagers. They start out kind of as preteens, and they have all these rituals that they do in larger groups. And over time, over the course of about 4 years, they narrow down their choice, and then they pick the one. And so there's so much effort and energy invested that it's very costly to try to go through that all over again. Now, what they're not opposed to doing is kind of taking a break from their forever mate for a 2 to 3 year affair with another albatross, and then they go back.
And they come back.
Yeah.
And the other animal brings them back, lets them in?
I'm sorry, does another animal bring them back?
Well, yeah. I mean, let's say one leaves for a couple of years and then comes back after its fling. Does the other animal just willingly bring them back in?
Well, presumably they've been also going off and having a fling, and so they sort of we'll separate for a period of time, and then we'll come back to one another.
Okay, so with all this, everything we've been talking about right now, what does that tell you about just the species of anything on this planet? They're all the same.
Well, right. There's so many similarities, right? And this is what...
I bet ants would be the same.
Well, ants have a lot of, ants are superior cooperators. I mean, they're really the level, when I think about how hard it is for so many people on our planet to just cooperate at a basic level. And then you see ants that, when there's a flood, form a raft of their bodies so that no one drowns. And they just do this. And they're, because there's inherent value in every single individual. And it requires every individual to cooperate.
I used to knock down ant hills just to watch how long it would take them to rebuild it. And then I started feeling bad.
Because they work so hard.
Yeah. I said, how would you like it if some big foot stepped on your house, George?
Right.
And, I'm like 10, 11 years old, and I'm saying, I wouldn't like that at all. So I stopped. I changed.
Well, I used to sit and just watch ants, and, I was always fascinated. There's always that sort of trail, and then there's that one that's sort of lost and off to the side, and he's wandering around in circles like he lost the scent, and I'm always like, gosh, just a little bit, a couple inches to your right, and you'll find it.
Do animals understand the difference between right and wrong?
I mean, it depends on how you define right and wrong. So if we think about something like a sense of fairness, animals have a very, very strong sense of what's fair and what's not fair. And, for example, there's a pretty famous experiment that was done with two capuchin monkeys, Virgil.
Those are the little tiny ones, right?
Yeah, like the organ grinder type.
Yeah.
Virgil and Vulcan. And so the way the experiment was set up was one of them had a jar with nuts in it, and the other one had the tool, the rock, that would slice the top so that you could get the nuts, but they were separated by a plexiglass window. And so the one who had the rock had to give it to the other one so that he could get the nuts out. And, of course, you had to trust that you're going to be fair, right, because you have all the nuts now. And there were 6 nuts total, and immediately there was no sort of hesitation. As soon as he accessed all the nuts, he gave 3 to his partner through the plexiglass window.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It truly is. The behavior and everything else. Is there remorse in an animal? Does it think sometimes that it was sorry for something it did?
Oh, absolutely. I think, remorse is not the same thing as shame. And I think that animals don't feel a sense of shame, but they have a sense of remorse. And we see this because, they make up after they've had a dispute. And one who will go to the other, maybe the one who actually committed the transgression, will go to the other and, in a sense, ask for forgiveness. And this might be, by putting out their hand. If it's a chimpanzee, they usually will put out their hand, and then they make up by a hug, right? Not unlike how we might make up when we've had an argument. If you're a raven, you make up by rubbing beaks more or preening the feathers, grooming the other individual as a way to say you're sorry and kind of make up.
Do they mourn?
Oh, absolutely. And I saw recently a video. You can see it just by looking at it. I mean, elephants are probably the most well-known for this. They have graveyards where all of the individuals will go, and they caress and pick up the bones of fallen family members.
They grieve, don't they? Hold on, Jennifer. We're going to hit this break here, and then we're going to come right back and take phone calls and stories with you. We're talking about Wild Connection here on Coast to Coast AM.